Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I am the founder of BoiledLeather.com, a.k.a. All Leather Must Be Boiled, and a Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones blog. I cover Game of Thrones and other television shows for Rolling Stone, and I am the co-author of the official annotated to Game of Thrones for Subtext.com with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros and series editor Ann Grohl. And joining me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am a essayist for the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And we are going to talk today about the short story Rogue, The Rogue Prince, that has come up in the anthology Rogues, which is more or less the complementary piece to The Princess and the Queen, which was in turn published in the anthology Dangerous Women. So just in case you for some reason have lived under a rock the past months. So what we will be talking today about is, from one perspective, is this a good story? Do we like it as a short story in the Song of Ice and Fire universe? And on the other hand, of course, and go all nerdy on it and start analyzing the stuff that is in there. And I want to start with a kind of review of the thing as a story. I have written a more extensive review for The Tower of the Hand, and we will link to it so you can check that out if you're really interested in my views. But I didn't like it at all as a short story. I felt that it had no beginning, no end, no real middle thing, all that stuff that makes a story. There was no real arc. It just stopped because, as we know, The Princess and the Queen starts there. And I think it was just taken this way to fit the thematic title of this anthology, and that disappointed me a bit, because it just was even less a fun read than The Princess and the Queen was. On the other hand, of course, all this information that is in there is very, very interesting, and I'm pretty positive that we will go about it in a short while. But as a story, it was just really lacking for me.
Yeah, I think if you think about these excerpts from the GRR and Marillion, which I guess is now officially going to be called Fire and Blood when it eventually comes out, which is this collection of false histories about the Targaryen dynasty, if you take those and you compare them to the other novellas that Martin has written that take place in the world of Ice and Fire and have appeared in his cross-genre anthologies that he co-edits with Gardner Dozois, those are the Duncan Egg stories. And those are really tightly written stories. The Mystery Knight I'm not as wild about as the other two, but they have very cohesive structures. I think he's kind of pastiching a different genre in each one. They reveal elements of this world that he's created that I'm trying to think how to put it. Basically, I just think they're actual genuine short stories or novellas. This stuff, on the other hand, is, you know, what it says it is, which is just an excerpt from like a larger fake, you know, sort of mockumentary about Westeros. And I do wonder if there are readers out there who feel like it's been a bit of a bait and switch. Like, they buy these story anthologies expecting a story, and they get that kind of interestingly written Wikipedia entry. I don't know. I mean, I enjoy it, and I wonder how much of that has to do with the context that I just read The Rogue Prince in. I didn't really actually read it. I listened to it on audiobook. And the two books I did that with immediately preceding The Rogue Prince were Marvel Comics' The Untold Story by Sean Howe and Nixonland by Rick Perlstein, both of which are popular histories. And I was very much in the mood to listen to someone tell me interesting stories about the past. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was prepped for it, and it was narrated by Ian Glenn, which is a heavenly experience to have Ian Glenn read to you. I just only wish he could feed me grapes at the same time. But it was... So I still enjoyed it, but I think absolutely it's really no more a story about a rogue prince than The Princess and the Queen was a story about The Princess and the Queen. I mean, Jesus, Alicent is barely in The Princess and the Queen.
Heavily in Rogue Prince, though.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And in a lot of ways, Daemon does more... You know, Daemon's coolest... The coolest thing Daemon ever does is when he dies, and that happens in... And the nastiest thing that Daemon ever does... Both those things also happen in The Princess and the Queen. So you can see how he sort of fudged his way into these anthologies he was writing because he needed a venue for this stuff. Or he needed his own... He needed to contribute to the anthologies that he had agreed to do without taking time away from his work on Ice and Fire-related material. So it doesn't... It's an odd fit, for sure. I think it works as what it is. It doesn't necessarily work as what it's supposed to be in the context of these anthologies.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I also think it's interesting to look at the two stories together. Stories. I'm just going to say stories instead of whatever.
Texts.
You know. Texts, sure. Let's look at the two texts together. Because one of the things that was most interesting to me about The Rogue Prince was how much you wind up learning about The Princess and the Queen. There is a lot of references, for example, in The Princess and the Queen to the Strongs calling Rhaenyra's kids with Laenor Velaryon Strongs. And because you don't get a bit about Sir Harwin potentially being their father until towards the very end, and it's a throwaway line, you could blink and you miss it. I'm sitting the whole thing as like, why are they... Is Strong a bastard name I'd never heard of before? The one that fell out of favor? I know there was a House Strong. It was odd. And now, all of a sudden, now you know exactly what happened and how it happened and why it happened and that it was a big deal and a scandal and people got their tongues cut out for it. That's cool. That's interesting. It's very interesting to find out that there was a story to why Sir Criston Cole became the Kingmaker on behalf of Aegon against Rhaenyra. That it wasn't just he's, you know, that there were, he had personal reasons, although those are in dispute, for doing this. It wasn't just a political move. All that stuff is compelling to me.
Absolutely. I think much of the background we now get for The Princess and the Queen makes all of this much more logical in a way, you know. It is even more obvious than with the books proper. So much of the information you get in A Dance with Dragons, for example, explains many of the things and tidbits we got in previous novels.
Yeah.
And this is just the same experience condensed really, really tight.
Right.
So... that is undoubtedly true. The one thing I was criticizing was the manner in which it was published, because it was so obviously just to fit in these strange anthologies in which they had no place to be other than name-dropping George R. R. Martin.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get over that.
Mm-hmm.
So of the information we were getting, I think the impression that I got is even more strong now than from the excerpts about the Rhoynar that we discussed last time, that the world before the Targaryen dynasty, see what I mean? The Targaryen dynasty, before it was toppled, the world was a more magical, more adventure-y place. You know, you have people flying on dragons to Valyria to dug out old swords and all that kind of stuff that just doesn't happen in the Duncan Egg stories or in Game of Thrones proper.
Yeah.
So there is a totally different feel to the early Targaryen dynasty that it has to it. And I am not quite sure in which direction this is going, you know, what the gist of it is. It certainly reinforces this idea that magic died out when the dragons died out. This becomes a much stronger idea now that we see how magical the world was only 150 or 200 years away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a one thematic thing I am taking from these texts.
Yeah, that's a good point. There is an element to it that's a little bit larger than even the comparatively large life of the epic fantasy setting of A Song of Ice and Fire proper. You know, it is really rather remarkable, I think, to think of. Just think of Dragonstone, for example, that instead of, like, you know, Stannis Baratheon's, you know, sad man castle, it's you know, it's an island that's literally crawling with dragons. You know, they live under the mountain and they come out and they fly around and eat sheep and, you know, I mean, it's nuts to think about that.
It's really strange.
Yeah.
It's like in The Princess and the Queen when there was this bit about them taking the dragons to Little flying over King's Landing and all people are looking up in awe. This is just such a different feel. You would expect it from Dungeons and Dragons, but not from a Game of Thrones.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing I liked about the story is that it's, in a lot of ways, it's not just one story, because the maester who's telling it repeatedly cites multiple conflicting sources.
Mushroom.
Yes, Team Mushroom. Team Mushroom for sure. First of all, how does a fool write a popular history?
I guess he has a good prose.
I guess so. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, if we're going to talk about it seriously, you know, it seems that he's a fool simply because he's a dwarf. You know,
he's basically Tyrion without Lannister.
Right. This, exactly. It's not that he's not Patchface or Moonboy. He's just a sharp dude who happens to be really short. And Randy. Yeah, I think
Tyrion without Lannister.
Exactly, good point. I guess you already made that point. So it's different than The Princess and the Queen, where you get a little bit of that, and then you start, and you also at times, I think, wonder what the maester who wrote its personal position is on things. But here to have the conflicting stories just placed one after the other, you know, sometimes he suggests which one he finds the most believable, other times, you know, he kind of just leaves it to the reader, I guess. But that, I like that a lot. And I guess I would generally say that I trusted Mushroom over, let's say, Septon Eustace.
Never trust a Septon.
No, of course not. But in a way, in the end, it does matter, because it who you trust, it can help determine how you feel about Prince Daemon, how you feel about Criston Cole, how you feel about Rhaenyra, and so it does matter.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about Daemon, because I think he is really an interesting subject, and I mean, he is the title character after all.
Yeah.
I remember that back when we talked about The Princess and the Queen, I was much of the opinion that I really disliked Daemon in the way you dislike well-written antagonists, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think this guy on the Iron Throne would be a catastrophe. It would end in fire and blood, really. And this is not something you want to have. And the Rogue Prince only adds to that. Daemon is a very intelligent guy. He clearly knows what he's doing. But on the other hand, he is also incredibly reckless, dangerous, arrogant, and dark, really. You know, he has all these dark urges that are only reinforced by his high birth, by his access to dragons, by his knowledge about lore, and all that kind of stuff. This guy is, a Rogue Prince, the title is apt.
Yeah, at the same time, could you really argue that we would have been better, that Westeros would have been worse off had he just been, you know, made the heir? I don't know, because things wound up being so fucking awful that it's difficult to come up with, well, Daemon would have been worse. Would he have been? Than the Dance of the Dragons? That's
it is very likely that if the Dance of the Dragons had been avoided, that the dragons wouldn't have gone in, extinct.
Right.
And I think the dragons going extinct is nothing bad.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have for this argument I have gotten some heat in the past, but I'm willing to still reinforce it because for me the dragons are a weapon that is really comparable to what atomic weapons were in our day and age.
Yeah.
And as something that getting rid of is an inherently good thing, even if there is some negative side effect to be had from it. For example, that wars are getting bigger. But that is a political problem that Westeros has solved at times and failed to solve at other times. And the dragons weren't any guarantee that wars wouldn't be created all the time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So I still say good riddance, and that is one of the cases for Daemon not sitting the Iron Throne.
I think that I swear the sentence has come out of my mouth before, but I think that we are predisposed to seeing the extinction of the dragons as a bad thing. One, because we're fantasy readers and we like dragons, and two, because we know, or we assume we know, what dragons' role will be in defeating the threat of the others. But if you're, you know, Joe Smallfolk, or if you're a maester participating in a supposed Grand Maester conspiracy against magic in general and dragons in particular, then I think you're right. Then I think you probably would see things the way you do, which is that dragons are nuclear weapons that only one family, essentially, can even use. And that's not a good system.
Dragons and magic also are very potent preservers of the status quo.
Yes.
Because with all this magic and these dragons and so on, you have a very heroic society, and heroic societies tend to put a large emphasis on some very few, very special people, and oftentimes these guys are of nobility. And I guess in a world without dragons, you have much more chance for people to climb up the ladder. I mean, we're talking about Westeros, but still, the maesters are providing a very small window of opportunity for several people, and there is no comparable thing in a dragon world. So things like that are definitely things that are keeping me biased against dragons.
Yeah, and in Daemon's case in particular, while it is difficult to conjure up a scenario where he's worse in the short term than the Dance of the Dragons, you know, he obviously has some very strong character defects, to say the least. Although, you know, he doesn't... His worst act, I think, is hiring Blood and Cheese to execute children. Right.
I forgive him for that.
No, and I guess it's important to keep that in mind, that that's where this character is headed, and that this character has that potential in him. But you know, I guess what's his roguishness in this one is basically like he's a womanizer and he doesn't really appear to give a shit about the feelings of the women involved. From the bronze bitch to Rhaenyra, if what it says is true, and he basically decided it would be fun to break Rhaenyra in.
He's also rogue in a political sense because he's currently fucking up any political order that Viserys is trying to achieve. I mean, Viserys is really bad at it.
Yeah.
But Daemon for sure doesn't help.
Yeah, that's true. Daemon, as much as anybody, since he didn't have a direct role in the conflict between Rhaenyra and Alicent until much later, could have been conciliatory but chose not to be.
Yeah, Daemon is in a lot of ways like Joffrey. It is a possibility if you imagine Joffrey as a second son or a cousin or something. You know, a guy who has a chance to get at the throne, who has all the privilege that comes with it, and all these character defects, but who isn't really in a position. I guess a Joffrey getting 20 or something could behave in many ways like Daemon does.
Yeah.
Not as intelligent, and I guess we will come to his political feats in a moment, but from his contempt for other people, and this does not only extend to the women he fucks, it is a general contempt of people and of blood and death. You can see this in all the wars he's fighting. Mm-hmm. He doesn't give a shit about other people. He doesn't even have clear objectives. I mean, this war on the Stepstones is basically just passing time.
Right. The war on the Stepstones is really interesting because, I feel like I'm saying a lot of things are really interesting and that's lame. I'm gonna try and do better, podcast listeners, with my word choice. But anyway. He declares himself king, and that seems, like, criminal to me, doesn't it? I mean, wouldn't you think that that's against the laws of Westeros? You're the king's brother, and you put a fucking crown on your head and declare yourself king of some other place?
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's just weird. I guess he renounced that crown when he wound up coming back, but he wasn't attainted, you know? I mean, it's just...
Yeah, that's Viserys. The guy is politically an idiot, and Daemon, the daring and reckless nature that he is, will exploit the weakness that he finds. As Joffrey exploits any weakness that Robert is offering, you know, getting in between these rifts and clefts and stuff, and abusing the power that he has.
Yeah.
So making himself king of a small kingdom just because he can.
Right. Well, I mean,
it's just a move that Joffrey would take, you know.
It's an amazingly utilitarian choice of places to become king of, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like, okay, well, here's a political situation that's proven unpopular with people who I need their support. And I have a guy who's kind of unhappy with my brother, too, and he's got a huge fleet, and he's nearby. And all the stars align, so I'm going to make myself king of this place that's very convenient to do that in. That's really, you know what I mean? It's not like he declared himself king of beyond the wall, you know? It's like, here's a place where there's a fleet that's taking too much money from people. I have a fleet. I'm going to take less money from people. That'll make me popular. I'm king of here now. Get out of here. You know, it's very, very, well, it's smart. But again, it's also like, what does he give a fuck? You know? That's the thing. I think what is really kind of fascinating about this entire period of history, when you think about these the greens and the blacks, Daemon, these conflicting factions, is all of them live lives of unimaginable splendor and privilege and power, but they'll like bankrupt and beggar and bleed and burn the entire fucking realm to sit the Iron Throne, you know, or to put a crown on their heads. It's crazy.
Yeah, you can see why everyone wanted to get rid of these guys, not once, but twice and thrice. Yeah, I mean, there were two great councils and then the final rebellion, all to get them in check.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a little bit, you know, what's it to any of these people if they're like, well, instead of being king of, you know, I wonder if this is where you can really start pointing to duty and honor and things of that nature as being really fucked up. This is something, I think this is probably the first, was that the first podcast topic we ever tackled? But you know,
one was honor, I guess.
Yeah, you see that here where it's like, Rhaenyra's like, how dare all these people? They swore. You know, this is my crown. Legally. And she's right.
Yeah.
You know? But she's
also a woman.
Exactly. And well, there's another previous topic, you know, that you look at any catastrophe that befalls Westeros and you're never more than 2 degrees of separation away from institutionalized sexism, you know, and that happens here. The realm bleeds because of it. But yeah, I mean, you know, if Rhaenyra had it in her to just be like, oh, well, you know, I'm Princess of Dragonstone. My family's very rich, very powerful. I've got dragons. I will live and die a happy woman. That would have been that. But the sense that the system granted her this power by rights, and it's been taken away from her, drives her into war. That's a little troubling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that can lead us right to the politics of Viserys,
yes,
who is ultimately responsible for the whole mess,
mm-hmm,
because he can't keep his own house in order.
Right.
For one thing, he is constantly tolerating Daemon's antics and all the stupid stuff he's doing. And then he totally fails to enforce his decision to make Rhaenyra his heir, and then he further fucks it up by marrying the Hightower woman and bringing an ambitious family in that shares a deep enmity with the Rhaenyra branch of the family into power. So what is this guy thinking?
Well, he's an avoidant personality, and I think all of us have seen this in our own lives, people who go along to get along, people who work relentlessly hard to try and make everybody happy and wind up immiserating themselves and enabling a lot of the worst qualities in other people. And I think you see that here. There are so many points at which you can see what Viserys should have done, but would have upset people in the short term. So he does something different that winds up destroying everything in the long term. Like, let's take Daemon, for example. If he had attainted Daemon the moment Daemon declared himself king of the Stepstones, who would have given a fuck? You know? Or before that, when he was just being a general asshole. You know, found some pretext, some crime that he'd committed, because he's obviously out there committing crimes all the time, and put an end to it. Daemon has no power base. You know? He's allied with the Sea Snake, but not, you know, I mean, that was an alliance of convenience as much as anything else. You know, the Sea Snake could have found some other means to try and get some of his power back. You know, what would have been the harm? Well, he's my brother. Yeah, I mean, that's a crying shame, but send him to the fucking wall. You know? Because then it winds up being a disaster in the long run. Or the situation with the succession in the first place. Listen, I don't blame him for, you know, convening this council and having, making Rhaenyra his heir, instead of Daemon. Even though it kind of went against tradition a little bit, more than a little bit.
Yeah.
But then what should have been done is that, like, you know, until such time as I produce a male heir. And then, moment he had a boy, then it's over. You know, I feel bad for Rhaenyra, and it's not that I'm supporting that kind of system. I'm just saying, this is the world that he lives in. And it was clear instantly what kind of trouble there was going to be. So, I don't understand why he didn't do that.
Yeah,
If he had said it right up front and said, you know, listen, Rhaenyra, like, you're going to be the queen unless I have a boy. You know, she's not Ramsay Snow. She's not going to, like, murder kids in their crib. You know? She was a kid herself. So he gets married again, he has a boy, and everyone's like, oh, okay, that's the done deal then. If he had just gotten in front of it, but he didn't.
Yeah. It all comes from this weakness as a ruler and of not really understanding the dynamics upon which your own rule is based on. This one very pervasive point I always find in Stephen Edgewell's analysis of A Game of Thrones, that Eddard Stark never really understood the office of the Hand of the King.
Mm-hmm.
I think Viserys I doesn't really understand what being king is about.
Yeah, yeah.
He is the offspring of a guy named the Conciliator, but I guess he took the wrong lessons from his father, as happens so often. He overstates this conciliatory point to which he becomes basically the tool of everyone around him. And there are plenty of people around him to make him a tool. There is, in later life, Rhaenyra. There is his wife. There is his good father. It is good father, right? Otto Hightower. And there is Daemon, of course. And Daemon is, in his actions, pretty... pretty ruthless and pretty efficient when he sets his mind to it. That's the interesting thing about Daemon. He doesn't give two fucks about ruling. When he is on the small council, it just bores him to death.
Right.
And he is happy enough to be exiled from the damn thing, which is just another point that really speaks against him sitting the Iron Throne ever. He would just have been Robert.
He's Robert, yep.
Yeah, he's Robert, but much more brutal, much more Targaryen-like.
Yeah.
And he has dragons. That's really a bad combination.
Right.
And... when you look at his tenure as Lord Commander of the City Watch, it is really a dramatic shift that happens here. When Daemon becomes commander of the City Watch of King's Landing, the City Watch is a group of 100 or 200 guys that are really bad paid and can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he transforms it not only in an efficient police force, but into his own army.
Yeah.
2,000 or 3,000 strong, really well-armed, and totally and utterly loyal to him. I just never bought it that much in The Princess and the Queen when they said, oh, he was the commander once, and since then you're all loyal to him. And
yes.
I thought, why the fuck?
Why?
But now, okay.
Now you understand.
That's kind of a different matter,
yeah.
You know? Now I understand it. And that is just so clever. But if he isn't interested in something, then he just won't do it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, one last thought. The thing that Viserys should have done is find something that he is interested in, give him the damn job, and let him do it.
Right.
Quelling rebellions somewhere.
Yeah.
That is the job he should do.
Yeah. You know, I to talk about the City Watch for a second. You know, I think that's actually a genuine achievement on Daemon's part. I think that's something that probably that city and Westerosi civilization needed. The capital needed a police force. They needed to have some self-respect. They needed to command some respect. You know, but you already instantly see, you know, the seeds of Janos Slynt are planted right there at the very beginning. You know, because as you said, even though he instituted these structural reforms and their uniforming and their weaponry and their tactics and so on, he also made it his personal goon squad. And I felt like a strong king would have seen that instantly and done something to prevent it on a structural level, you know, like something akin to,
I am,
you take away the maester's last names, you don't make Castle Black defensible from the south, those kinds of things where you're trying to ensure that a certain kind of conflict can't happen. That should have been done from the start. I don't know what it would have been. I mean, maybe if I sat here for 5 minutes, I could have come up with something. But you can't have a situation where...
Simply let them swear an oath on the king as their supreme commander.
Yep. Yeah, that would do it. I mean, that then you have another problem, which is that now they're the King's Goon Squad, but in theory, everybody in Westeros is the King's Goon Squad, you know, so, yeah, there should have been some sort of checks and balances put in place, and there wasn't, and that's just like a very small example of Viserys fucking up, you know, but I mean, by the time, is it Lucerys is putting out Aemon's eye, and the moms are calling to have each other's eyes poked out and having people, kids, like, put to the question, like, what's wrong with you?
And it sounds like a sensible solution, you know?
You know, I mean, you just watch it all get away from him and watch him, like, paper over it with, you know, the maester who writes the story, whose name I can't remember, is constantly saying, you know, Viserys is really open-handed and they lavish gifts and honors and titles and offices on... there are many favorites, and people seem to like him, but another problem, I think, is that everybody close to him picked a side. You know?
Yeah, and no one picked the king's side.
Yeah,
picked
no one...
has no side.
He had no strong, neutral voice saying, do you see what's happening, Your Grace? You know? He was surrounded by fucking Hightowers and Rhaenyra herself and Alicent and Daemon and you know, people who couldn't be trusted to be honest brokers with him. And it led to disaster. And I think it's worth seeing how you can be a good king for the here and now, but the second you're gone, everything turns to shit immediately, which is literally... Well, it didn't literally turn to literal shit, but I'm saying, you know, it was a disaster within minutes of his death. You know? Within hours of his death, people were being murdered.
Yeah.
And high treason was declared by his small council. So, that's bad news.
Yeah, definitely. At this point, I have to give out a small warning. Germany is currently playing in a soccer match against France, and it will end in a few minutes. So if you hear a sound like a King's Landing riot in a few minutes, that's because the soccer match has ended, which I'm not interested in. But my neighbors, unfortunately, are.
I thought I heard some cheering. I was like, oh, I bet that's.
Yeah, that's just, they're beating crap out of France just now.
Nothing changes. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, I don't know what else there is to say about Viserys.
I guess we covered him pretty much. There is this small matter or an information that's really just in the beginning, if I remember correctly, that old Jaehaerys fought some wildling king with his dragon.
Yes, yes. Oh, thank you for bringing that up.
It was just another what the fuck moment.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know that I've often brought up the idea that maybe the Targaryens stayed away from Westeros because they were afraid of skin changers, which is something that I'd read. It's not like I came up with that on my own. But obviously, we already knew from the Queen's Crown or whatever that Queen Alysanne, and I think we knew the Old King flew up there with their dragons at some point. We didn't know that he fucking flew over the wall and attacked wildlings with a dragon.
Yeah, it's really...
That's crazy.
Yeah, so, I just found it here. He flown a dragon north of the wall to defeat a vast host of wildlings, giants, and warwicks. This is... I mean, why?
Yeah, I that's amazing. I guess they were very vast.
It is not beyond the wall, you know. It is to the wall. So the shit seemed to have hit the fan.
No, doesn't it say? It says north of the wall, right?
No, it's north to the wall. So,
north to the wall.
It's a little bit ambiguous.
Maybe he didn't fly over.
Yeah, we simply don't know. It can go either way.
Yeah.
But that's just what I meant with this whole magic thing, you know. We have this wildling army in a Storm of Swords, granted, even with the anchor from the TV series. But we are talking about dragons attacking greenseers. This
right.
is just great.
No, that's exciting shit. And I do wonder if it how it factors into various theories about how that sort of thing would work.
I guess it will have looked a little bit like in Sucker Punch, if you have seen that movie, when they attack this castle with the orcs.
No, I haven't.
Okay, but I guess it looks kind of similar. And there are these elements of magic that are in there, and I guess stories like Daemon's quests in the East have been told even after the Targaryens fall, which might just be the inspiration for people like Jerry and Lannister to go on a ship, sail to Valyria, and recover their ancestral grants and take with them the damn sword.
Yeah, that does seem like something that people who fancy themselves heroic and adventurous and bold do. You know, from
second Daemon Targaryen, I will find a dragon egg and hatch it, and then I'm going to fly and impress my brother Tywin. This is just the kind of stuff people do.
Yeah, Euron Greyjoy.
Yeah.
Oh man, this is for a short story. I feel like there is really a lot to talk about in here. I don't know, some of it is just kind of fun and juicy to think about, like all the business with the Rhaenyra and Laenor household and their various affairs, and that whole marriage of convenience is just fun to read about, I think.
This is all very fun, and I really like to do it. I mean, I have written essays about the history of Westeros, and this is a totally made-up history. So, I guess they just bungled it.
Oh, I have a grand theory, by the way, if you were curious.
Oh, yeah, something.
I think this is... I'm trying to remember if I'm getting this straight. Okay. So, the two Strongs, the one who's the Hand, and then the... break back. They travel back to Harrenhal after the whole debacle with the kids fighting over the dragon and calling them Strongs and stuff. And then there's a fire that kills them both.
We won.
We won. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. I don't give a shit.
So they go back. The fire kills them both. And, you know, there's various theories that maybe it was the sea snake, because Breakback cuckolded his son. Maybe it was King Viserys, for creating this whole scandal. Maybe it was Daemon to remove a rival. Had anyone suggested, I don't remember from the story, but had anyone suggested that the fire was caused by the Clubfoot?
I haven't read it at any rate. So I'm really not sure.
Oh yes, others have put forth the notion that Larys Clubfoot might have been responsible. With his father and elder brother dead, Larys Strong became the Lord of Harrenhal.
Yeah, that makes sense. But it is also very obvious. I read a theory that it was Viserys himself, but I don't remember why.
You know, what I'm curious is, how does any of this play into Larys Clubfoot's role in the events of The Princess and the Queen, where he's the one who spirits Aegon and his kids out of King's Landing when King's Landing falls to Rhaenyra. But meanwhile, it also seemed likely, to me at least, that he was for a time Prince Daemon's mole on the Green Council.
Maybe.
I couldn't figure out who else that was. I mean, maybe I had a different theory. A lot of times I'll have different theories over the course of many months and forget them in the intervening months, but so I do kind of wonder if this event ties into that in some way, if they had some kind of arrangement, but then Larys pulled a double cross or a triple cross over the deaths of his family. I don't know.
It's all very strange and very very tangled. I just don't have a real opinion on it because I'm feeling that we lack the essential information to really get it.
Right. You know? I guess we always will, and that's kind of the fun of it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I love theorizing about it, no question.
You just kind of have to tease it out yourself, for sure.
There are some small details that I've dug up researching a little bit. For example, that Joffrey is obviously a Stormlands name, which comes a little bit as a surprise, but it makes sense.
Oh, you know, sure, right.
For Robert to name his son Joffrey, and for Joffrey Valerian, because he was born in the Stormlands. So that makes kind of sense. Now, then there is also the question of this Grand Maester that has been fed to Sunfire, which doesn't make sense yet from the timelines we know. But this may just be the unreliable narrator or Martin fucking up. You never know.
Yeah.
Then this thing about Grand Maester Gerardus, or however you want to spell him, you know, the one.
Yes.
I think he's the one who also goes on this diplomatic mission to Rhaenyra, and brings the official position of Aegon II. And I always wondered how easy he got off. And there is this theory out there that I read that he is a mole for Rhaenyra actually on the council, which makes sense. We learned that he was her personal maester, so that might just be a bond here.
Maybe he was the friend in the Green Council.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that could be. That could be for sure. I don't know. I'm just kind of sitting scanning the I just remember I really did enjoy reading this, I have to say.
Yeah, I guess I have to read it again because I didn't enjoy it the first time around, simply for the literary quality. But I have to read it again for the information.
Yeah, I think that, like I said, I came in so well prepared for this kind of thing that it just suited me very well. And then after I listened to it a few times, because it's short to listen to an audiobook, it's like 45 minutes or so. No, it's an hour and a half. So then I went right from it into The Princess and the Queen, and that's very, I recommend that. You know, because then you really do feel like you're getting the full story. I assume there'll be a third one that takes you to the end of The Dance of the Dragons in the next cross-genre anthology.
Most likely, yes.
You know, maybe they'll do a cross-genre anthology about, like, kids having adventures, and this will be about Aegon the Younger. Yeah. That's my guess. I'm calling it right now.
Okay.
Well, then, I guess we shall say goodbye for the day. I'll let you celebrate your country's great victory.
Yeah, I will do so by video gaming.
All right. Well, thank you, Stefan, for talking to me, and thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you for talking to me, and you all guys to listen to us, and my neighbors. So next time, hopefully, the World Cup will be over, and then we will be able to get our conversation in peace. So until then, goodbye and good luck.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.